Chapter 19, It's Greek to Me by Willie Snow Etheridge. 19. An Egyptian Interlude. One afternoon, towards the end of my stay in Greece, I was told that two United States government planes were leaving the following morning, one for Constantinople and the other for Cairo, or, as I always say, Cairo, Egypt, to distinguish it from Cairo, Georgia, and there was a free seat in either of them for me. Well, nothing since reaching Athens ever threw me into such a tailspin. Of course, I had never been to either place, and more than likely, I'd never have another chance to go to either. Which to choose, that was the problem. Naturally, I couldn't decide it alone. I took it with me to a farewell reception that Ambassador and Mrs. McVeigh were having for Paul Porter, and there, just like Elmo Roper, Pope. 108 said Constantinople, and 108 said Cairo, Egypt, and 35 had no opinion. I was wild. Paul Porter was wild. Instead of concentrating on Paul's departure, as they had been invited to the party to do, the guests were arguing the pros and cons of Constantinople and Cairo, Egypt, and some were even talking about Istanbul, which I thought pretty foolish and confusing, as I wasn't considering going there until Bill Corey told me it was another name for Constantinople. When I was just about ready to throw myself from a balcony, my friend, Mr. Keeley, decided the question for me. Calmly, he announced I had to have a visa to go to either country, and he couldn't possibly get me one by the next morning for Turkey, but he could for Egypt. So, weary from polling, but otherwise was all right, I set off early next morning for Egypt with about 17 other people, mostly old friends. They were traveling in a military plane attached to our United States Embassy in Athens, which was going to Cairo to buy supplies. For about 7 hours, we sailed south across the Mediterranean, blue and still as spilled ink. It was like a party. Some of us played gin rummy, some played bridge, some read, and some talked, until it came time for refreshments and we learned the ghastly fact that there were none. Nobody except the wife of a colonel who had tucked a tin box of cookies under her arm had brought along a morsel. The coast of Africa, when we first sighted it, looked more like a vast flood of yellow-red water than land. Peering down at it, I was sure that the Nile, thick with eroded soil, had crawled all over the visible continent, drowning out trees, houses, telephone poles, and roads. There was nothing except this wide, flat, brick-colored spread of, what? The old travelers said desert. I still felt it was water. Then suddenly to the right appears a long strip of jungle green. That, they tell me, is the valley of the Nile. My eyes bulge. It lies there, this dark green strip on the yellow-red sheet, as straight and neat as if an expert seamstress had stitched it down. I don't understand how a wild, savage river can enrich its banks with such primness. In the distance are the slim minarets of Cairo and beyond, stacked like children's blocks against the white sky, the pyramids. Slowly, we drop towards the earth, and I see on the desert, away from the green belt of the Nile, clusters of tall palms and, as we continue to lose altitude, small villages of mud huts about the size of shoeboxes. We land on the edge of the desert. The sand is ridged by the wind like sunken hollows on seashores. Eye-achingly bright and hot, the sun beams down, but there is a brisk breeze. Flies light on our legs, hands, faces. As usual, I don't know where I'm going or how I'm going to get there. Fortunately, there are two other women in the party who are as vague as I am. Andre Ross, the wife of Charles Ross, one of the secretaries of the embassy in Athens, and a young Canadian whom I know only as Louise. We have no friends in Cairo to visit and, what is worse, no hotel reservations. We confer with the stewardess behind a counter in the airport. She looks solemn. There are no hotel rooms in Cairo this week, for there is a convention of manufacturers. Not, I cried, the National Association of Manufacturers. She isn't familiar with the NAM, but these are Egyptian manufacturers, and the result is the same. There are no rooms. The thing to do, we decide, is to go into Cairo and begin visiting hotels. We pile into the only available vehicle, a closed truck belonging to the United States Army. Riding in it, I feel as if I had been raided in a nightclub and am on my way to the police station. Nevertheless, I begin to argue with Andre and Louise that we must go to the pyramids and Sphinx this very afternoon. We have only what is left of this afternoon, and it is now 3 o'clock, and the next day to do everything. The pyramids, the Sphinx, the bazaars, the mosque, the Nile, and the shops, so we must not lose 1 second. Across the truck from me sits a strange man. Calmly, he listens to my arguments, and when I finish, leans over and announces, "Lady, you are over-anxious to see the pyramids." My supposed to be friends from Athens whoop, "She's over anxious to see everything." After that, I sit subdued in my corner and peer out the open back door of the truck. As we come into the suburbs of Cairo, I see men walking about in long white nightgowns. They've escaped from a hotel fire in the middle of the night, I think first. But then I notice they all wear on their heads those little red hats like the fezes the Shriners wear at conventions in the United States, and I realize they are fully clothed in their fashion. Down the center of the street are spacious parks with palms, bougainvillea, oleander, snapdragons, salvia, wisteria. We stop in front of a white stucco hotel with many wings in the midst of luscious lawns and flower beds. It reminds me of the Breakers in Palm Beach, Florida, where during an affluent period I once had lunch. It is the Heliopolis Palace in the new and fashionable suburb of Heliopolis. The crew of the plane want to stop there because it is nearer to the airport than the city hotels. "See if they have any rooms for us," Andre, Louise, and I cry at their disappearing backs. But when the pilot returns and says, "Yes, there are one double and one single room left," we don't want to stop there. It's too far out. We will try in the city first. In arriving in front of the world-renowned Shepherd's Hotel, an imposing affair with a huge open terrace across its entire facade, we hand our bags down from the truck and hop out. Instantly, we are attacked by 8 or 10 long-robed, shawl-wrapped guys. They thrust their swarthy faces into our faces. They shove their nightgown bodies against our bodies. They shout their qualifications down our throats. Each one of them is the smartest, the best read, the most reasonable, the most astute. Andre, Louise, and I are frightened out of our wits. Quickly, we hoist our suitcases back into the truck and crawl in behind them. Shaken in every nerve, we cower in a corner. Here we will stay until it is time for the plane to return to Athens. Gardner Patterson, a friend from Athens who was a passenger on the plane but left us to find his Cairo host, appears at the tailboard of the truck. "Come out," he urges, as if he were talking to children or horses. "Don't be afraid. I'll protect you until you get into the hotel." Encouraged, we climb back out, but it is a mistake. Nobody can protect us. The guides grab our shoulders, spray us with spittle, shake their fingers in our faces. Gardner Patterson himself shoves us back into the truck. "Stay right there," he now insists. "Don't move. I'll go into Shepherd's and see what I can find out." He reappears with friends. They stand in the road, fenced around by arguing guides, and shout to us in the truck. "There are no rooms for us in the hotel, but we can check our bags there if we can make it inside. Perhaps now." For the third time, we hand out the suitcases and follow behind. For the third time, the guides, like wolves, are upon us. "I am the son of a sheikh," yells one. "It is not every day you can have the son of a sheikh for a guide." "You are a son of a..." and Louise lets him have it. She has been a lady as long as she can stand it. After listening to her for a horrified moment, I am astounded that she ever was one. The only possible explanation is that she has been sleepwalking. I actually begin to feel sorry for the guys, but I needn't. They recognize they have met their match and slink away. In the hotel, we stop just long enough to check our bags and so telephone Heliopolis Palace to hold those rooms for us. We will be there as soon as we have visited the pyramids and the Sphinx. We hire a taxi for the trip. We cross the Nile and see the white boats tied to the palm-shaded shores. We ride along a fashionable boulevard lined with acacia trees and handsome stucco houses, sitting far back from the street, half buried in palms and other tropical growth. Louise has a small guidebook, and as we near the pyramids and the Sphinx, we begin to study it. It gives us directions for seeing the Sphinx at its best. After leaving the rest house, it says, you reach the barbed wire fence and the Sphinx reveals itself to you. It looks to the east. Now turn to the left, admiring the Sphinx from the distance. We wonder who writes guidebooks anyway. Not heaven knows that we could do better, but at least we wouldn't have the Sphinx revealing itself. The pyramids are a shock. They are simply gigantic stacks of stone blocks piled one on top of the other until they form huge tent-shaped structures that blot out sizable triangles of the sky. There are three of them, but the most famous is the Pyramid of Cheops, which was built by Cheops, or Khufu, about 3733 BC. Why he wanted to do it, Greek to me, unless there was a depression in Egypt, and he figured piling stones on top of one another was better for the unemployment than raking leaves. It took 100,000 men working 3 months a year for 20 years to build it, and they used 2,300,000 blocks of stone weighing an average of 2.5 tons apiece. Standing in the sand at the foot of it, Andre, Louise, and I consider climbing it. The guidebook says frankly, to ascend the pyramids is not dangerous, but tiresome. It can be done with the help of two strong Arabs, one to hold each hand and one to pull you up. Now just what does that mean? How can one Arab hold each hand? But, granting for the sake of argument one can, then what does that leave the other Arab to pull with? The hair of the head? The nose? The teeth? We pursue the book for further guidance. There is nothing on the pull problem, but it does say you can employ a third one to push behind. Reluctantly, we pass up the climb. We will content ourselves with hiking about the base. But no sooner do we start hiking than we are approached by Arabs with camels who insist on our riding. Now neither Andre nor I is in condition to ride camels. Andre is 6 months pregnant and she doesn't think she will feel well or look well on a camel. I, for once, am not pregnant, but I am wearing the very slim and tight-fitting skirt to my best traveling suit and my Saks Fifth Avenue hat, which sits tilted with a full-blown bow over one eye and makes me look, I think, like the wife of the United States delegate on the Balkan Commission, and I can't see myself in this get-up on a camel. Nevertheless, the Arabs out-talk us and we mount, but not Louise. She simply tells the Arabs what she thinks of camels and proceeds on foot, a little to our rear, reading the guidebook to us at the top of her voice. We are a sensation. Everybody with a camera, and that means everybody, leaves off taking pictures of the pyramids and begins taking pictures of us. The minute they see us, they lose interest in everything else. This, their amused faces say, they can't miss. We don't blame them, but I wonder what they will say when they are back home showing the movies they have made of the pyramids to trapped guests. And instead of the pyramids, dear Andre overtopping the hump of the camel, and I, with my skirt to my thighs and my lady chairman hat, and Louise trailing in the dust, her nose in the guidebook, hove across the screen. "Good Lord, who are they?" I can hear the guests screaming. "Who, them? Oh, them? Oh, gosh, you know, what queer-looking people one sees traveling." Or perhaps they will say, "We are throwbacks to the Sphinx, neither man, woman, nor beast." One of our camel drivers is enchanted with the Sphinx. "Ah," he ahs loudly as we teeter down a steep incline and glimpse it for the first time. "There the Sphinx, there's the Sphinx, that mystery of all the ages." "I'm glad you like it," says Louise in a tone that says plainly she does not. "The Sphinx dates back to 3000 B.C., the driver says. "It is a great riddle in Egyptology. Nobody could ascertain why it was built." "He has learned that from the guidebook," Louise declares bitterly. "He's just an old fake." The Arab ignores the interruption. It is interesting to know that it is 50 feet high from the pavement to the crown of his head. "Who says it's interesting?" Louise demands. "And 180 feet long from the root of the tail to the forepaw," he continues in imperturbably. "The nose is 5 feet 7 inches and the smiling mouth..." "I see nothing smiling about it." Louise turns impatiently and starts back up the rise. "Come on," she calls over her shoulder. "I've had enough of this." The sun has set, or as the driver remarks, the sun has come down now, and the sky in the west is a pink, so intense that the air and the sand of the desert are pink too. Happily, Andre and I move through this soft, roseate sea to our starting point at the foot of the Pyramid of Cheops. By the time we reach the Heliopolis Palace, it is black night, and we are faint with hunger. Having had nothing to eat all day except a very light breakfast at an extremely early hour, we dress ourselves in our best and go into the impressive main dining room and feast on a sumptuous 5-course dinner. Soup, baked fish, chicken and casserole with exotic tasting herbs, and wine, 3 fresh vegetables, a green salad, and dessert, and all for the sum of $1. We decide people who work in Greece should live in Egypt and commute. The next morning, Andre and I are up before anyone else. We peer across the wide green lawns and empty streets, and we see the pale round face of the carousing moon above a slender minaret. Several hours later, we collect Louise and start for Cairo by streetcar. It is packed as a New York subway and tears madly along, rocking from side to side. Barefoot women in long flowing draperies carry large copper cans on their shoulders to the public pumps. Men relieve themselves in vacant lots. Carriages with mounds of clover beneath the driver's feet for the horses' noonday meal clop by. Small boys hug white ducks beneath their arms. Soldiers in helmets topped with silver spikes ride around in open trucks. Arab chiefs lounge against doorways, their elaborate turbans studded with jewels. Egyptian princesses glide past, thin veils over the lower halves of their faces, and gold ornaments on the bridges of their noses. Members of the king's household drive by in fire-red automobiles. As we step off the streetcar, a woman holds a baby out to us and begs for money. Knowing we can't give her money without being besieged by dozens, perhaps hundreds of other beggars, we shake our heads, but she continues to beg. We start up the street, and she follows at our heels, pleading, crying, sobbing. Finally, though, realizing we're not going to give her anything, she throws the baby down on the street and flounces off. A sheikh, at least we take him for a sheikh. He has white draperies flowing from his turban over his shoulders, strides past Louise and pinches her on the ding-dong. "The pig," she shrieks. "He pinched me, the dirty, filthy pig, the..." We join Gardner Patterson and his wife, Evelyn, for a trip to the bazaars. Here in narrow winding alleys, coppersmiths, goldsmiths, brasssmiths, weavers, black skull caps on their small heads, sit in front of their shops working at their trades. Ping, 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 tiny hammers. Ping, 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 pitchers, big pitchers, medium-sized pitchers, little pitchers, trays, coffee pots, coal scuttles, umbrella stands, vases, flower pots, ashtrays, candlesticks, card trays, jardiniere lamps, paperweights, nameplates, everything in brass and copper. They hang on the walls of the toy-sized shop. They tower on the shelves. They crowd the floor. There are also shops stacked with silver feather fans, shawls, brocades, silks, spices. Also shops with leather goods, suitcases, handbags, overnight cases, hat boxes, cigarette boxes, and card boxes. In the midst of our shopping, it begins to rain, which everybody says is impossible. It never rains in Cairo, everyone insists. Never, even Louise's guidebook declares. The climate is fine, and it rains only once or twice a year. Yet now it is pouring like a Kentucky flash flood, and there are no sewers to drain it off. The alleys turn into mud pies. The paved streets swell into rivers. The men hold up their nightgowns above their knees, and the women hoist their long, swirling draperies to immodest heights. The roof of the restaurant where we lunch is evidently made of bamboo shoots or palm leaves, for not only the rain comes through, but marbles of hail. The hail hits the tables and bounces about gaily. The customers are excited. They act as if they've never seen hail before, and certainly never before in an indoor restaurant. We asked at lunch of Eleni Angelopoulou's married sister, who lives in Cairo. She is distressed about the rain. All the mud huts in the country are, no doubt, collapsed, she mourns. Even when it never rains, they sometimes collapse. Can you imagine today what happens? She sighs. Here in Egypt, everyone is very poor or very rich. There are no in-betweens. But we do not let the rain stop us. We take a taxi and climb the Mokattam Hills to visit the citadel where the mosque, which is 700 lights, which look exactly like 1,700 fish bowls, hang from the ceilings and other sites, and then we shop. Andre and Louise, coming from Greece, where there is practically nothing to buy, are like crazy people shopping. They rush in and out of the innumerable shoe stores, trying on white shoes, red shoes, brown shoes, green shoes, beige shoes, white and brown shoes. In Athens, shoes cost $30 a pair. Here in Cairo, they are $4 and $5. Andre and Louise feel they must stock up for years to come. I'd like to see some shoes, Louise announces as she seats herself in a store. What kind of shoes, madam? Do I have to say what kind of shoes? She snaps. Well, it would be better, madam. I want to see everything you have except black. Naturally, after this shop, after the shoe boxes stack up around Louise like the pyramids, frantically she tries on pair after pair, and madly she buys pair after pair. Well, at least four or five pairs, and Andre, three. Then they're splashing in and out of stores for perfumes, pocketbooks, yard goods, silk ties, hair rinses. Only the thought of the hotel bill still to be paid stops us. When the hour arrives, it is deep night. Stores in Cairo choose clothes from noon until 3 and stay open in the evening, it seems, until everyone is finished shopping. We climb into a taxi for the long ride to the Heliopolis Palace, but we should have climbed onto a camel. Here, where it never rains, the streets are deeply flooded, and the taxi has to go up on the sidewalk to keep its hood above water. Finally, though, we make it, and exhausted, drop into our beds. End of chapter 19.